Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of March 29th. This week we were joined by Professor Andrew Basevich, Professor of History and International Relations at Boston University, and author of the article Deja Vu in Marja, Our Guiding Illusions in Afghanistan, which appears in the March 29th issue. We began our conversation by asking Professor Basevich to introduce us to the American campaign in Marja.
Well, after President Obama approved the so-called Afghan surge at the end of last year, that provided the basis for this new approach to waging the war in Afghanistan, the one proposed by General McChrystal in his famous assessment that was leaked to the press late last summer. The essence of that new approach is to apply counterinsurgency doctrine to Afghanistan. The essence of counterinsurgency doctrine, as it's currently understood by the United States military, is to focus less on trying to kill insurgents and more on trying to secure the population. Secure the population implies not only keeping them from harm, keeping them out of the clutches of the insurgents, but also providing an array of services, good governance, economic opportunity, schools, clean water, effective police forces. And Marja really is the test case, an effort to demonstrate that in Afghanistan this approach proposed by McChrystal can work.
Now, you note in your article for America that this is actually not the first time that the Marines have been in Marja. Maybe you can just give us a little history here.
Well, I've discovered this, frankly, just in reading a newspaper, and it caught me completely by surprise. But the fact is that back in the 1950s, I mean, over a half century ago, when President Eisenhower was in the White House, there was a similar effort undertaken not by the U.S. military, but by the American Agency for International Development to deliver good governance and economic opportunity and the like to Marja and its environs. The inspiration of that effort was not a Taliban insurgency, but rather it was the fact that there were concerns that the Pashtuns, tribal people in that region, would start to agitate to create a separate Pashtun nation state. This prospect was disturbing both to the Afghan government and to the Pakistani government. So the object of the exercise in this AID project was to try to nip this separatist movement in the bud by getting the Pashtuns to put down roots, to give up their nomadic ways, and to become, in effect, loyal Afghan peasants. The essence of the project was one in which the U.S. Funded the development of a large dam. The idea was to make it possible to irrigate the region, and by distributing land and mules and seeds that the Americans would basically persuade the Pashtuns to change their ways. This effort in the 1950s failed abysmally. And it seems to me that, to some degree, that failure ought to serve as a warning about whether or not this new effort to change the way they live is likely to succeed.
Yes, you note in your essay that there are certain, although obviously the United States tries to learn lessons from previous engagements, and in this case, its previous time in Marja, there are still certain assumptions that you lay out about the Pashtuns that may undermine the mission. Maybe you can just mention a couple of those.
Well, it seems to me that when we try to learn lessons, we try to learn lessons that really involve matters of tactics and technique. And we tend not to want to revisit the larger assumptions that inform policy. I mean, the largest assumption here is that we, coming from the West, coming from the developed world, coming from what we used to call Christendom, the assumption is that we have the capacity to understand what it is these people want, and that we have the capacity to deliver that. And there is an arrogance inherent in that assumption that we ought at least to confront, I think, and contemplate.
And this is what you refer to in your article as a deficit of self-awareness, correct?
That's absolutely correct.
One area that you mentioned specifically that the U.S. seems to be kind of has a blind spot is our commitment to secular modernity and how that is at odds with certain beliefs that Pashtuns and other Afghan groups may hold. Maybe you can talk more about that.
Yeah, I think this really, and I'm not the only one who said this, but I mean, I really do think that this gets to the very essence of the conflict and of the problem that we in the West face with an Islamic world that has been and may well continue to be a source of some violence. And the core issue is finding ways to reconcile belief with modernity. This was a problem within Christendom. It was a problem that produced centuries of violence in Christendom that was finally resolved basically by the end of the 18th century or so. And it was resolved, the reconciliation really was one of separation, that by and large most people in the West and certainly in the United States are comfortable putting religion and real life in a separate box. I mean, this may be good, it may be bad, but that's just the way it is for most people. And my general sense, not that I'm an expert on Islam and wouldn't want to pretend to be, my general sense is that Muslims have a very difficult time even contemplating the prospect of separating God from politics. And that's what modernity demands. And I think that the difficulty of doing that is the source of considerable dysfunction in the Islamic world. And our insistence on them doing that is one of the things that's likely to provoke continued hostility from Muslims.
Right. You mentioned, you quote an essay from Salman Rushdie where he talks about this. This was shortly after 9/11, saying that religion is largely a personal matter for Americans and most Westerners, but religion kind of infuses every decision that folks in Afghanistan make. And the quote here is that the deep politicization of Islam is a nizzle that all Muslim societies must grasp. And this is, from what you describe, a much more difficult task than the United States might fully understand.
Well, and it's not a task that can be resolved using using the methods or the techniques of modernity, you know, the notion that we're going to go over there and we're going to build schools and we're going to provide opportunities for people to do something other than grow opium poppies, and that those methods will get at the heart of this conflict, just strikes me as not very likely to yield success, and in many respects can actually yield simply greater hostility, because if you put yourself in their shoes, it's us outsiders coming in and trying to tell them what they need to do with their lives.
I wanted to bring up to an article I just was reading earlier today from the American Conservative that you also wrote about the campaign in Afghanistan, and some intriguing questions you raise about the traditional notion of war and whether it still works in kind of the age of nuclear weapons. There is still this understanding, specifically you cite some conservative thinkers, that war, as was thought of World War II, World War I, the kind of traditional idea of war still works. What is that idea of war, and you know, can it work in kind of this modern age with a different kind of enemy?
Yeah, the immediate response to the dropping of the atomic bomb was to persuade many people that war now really had become an impossibility, that the next war would almost necessarily involve nuclear weapons, and there was really no plausible political purpose that could possibly be served, and so it really seemed that war had reached a dead end. Military professionals, not simply in the United States, but certainly in the United States, military professionals kind of resisted that notion and spent a lot of time thinking and arguing about how the use of force would retain utility. Within the American military profession, that argument was particularly forceful in the wake of the Vietnam War, another experience that seemed to show that war had no political utility. And the solution that the Americans came up with in the 1970s and 1980s and into the 1990s was a new American way of war based on high technology and highly trained professional military force that seemingly had demonstrated the capacity to achieve victory in battle quickly and economically, with victory in battle there providing the basis for achieving the declared U.S. political purpose. And in a sense, Operation Desert Storm in 1991, although I think misconstrued, was seen as the case that demonstrated the political efficacy of military force in this new configuration. And indeed, it was the expectation that through battle, the United States military could win wars quickly and efficiently. It was that expectation that informed the initial expectations of what the U.S. would achieve in Afghanistan in 2001 and in Iraq in 2003. The fact of the matter is, in neither of those cases did the United States achieve that decisive victory. I mean, in both cases, the U.S. forces achieved considerable success, but in neither case were they able to end the war and therefore achieve the declared political purpose. I think what happened by 2006 and 2007 was that with the reinvention of counterinsurgency, the American military itself gave up on the notion of battle, and it gave up on the notion of victory, so that when U.S. forces talk about what they're trying to do today, for example, in Afghanistan, they don't talk about winning a military victory, and they don't talk about achieving a decisive outcome anytime soon. They are now engaged in a project of armed nation building, which even they concede is a long, drawn-out, complicated process and actually may end with a fairly ambiguous definition of success. Indeed, if we look at the Iraq case, which they cite as a success, we can see precisely how ambiguous that success is.
What do you think, what do you see happening, say, in 10, 20 years when the soldiers who have been fighting in these now long wars rise up within the ranks of the military? How will that shape the American military and the way that it approaches?
I don't know, but I mean, I hope that the service and sacrifice of American soldiers, the people, you know, the very small number of our fellow citizens who are bearing the brunt of this enterprise that began after 9/11, I hope that based on their own experiences in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, they will question much of the sort of lazy thinking about war that has helped to produce such a highly militarized approach to policy. I can't say that I see evidence of that questioning happening, but I think that if it's going to happen, that it's going to come from learning the lessons of Iraq and Afghanistan. If those lessons are to be identified and learned, it's going to come from within the officer corps, if it comes at all.
Well, Professor Andrew Bacevich, we want to thank you for taking some time to talk with us.
Thank you.
I want to thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the America Magazine podcast. Reminder to go online this week, where we have from the archives the editors on the fall of Vietnam from 1975, as well as follow George Anderson in our video commentary commenting on the murder of journalists throughout the world this year. Reminder that you can respond to our podcast by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.